Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein. Welcome to Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Today we are asking the question, is America's democracy failing? With our guest, Adam Lovin. It's been a difficult 8 years for us political philosophers. We were raised on ideas about justice, truth, and the rationality of voters, and the primacy of the rule of law. We wrote books on public deliberation, civic education, and equal treatment of fair institutions. We accepted that at some level there was a social contract which meant something, and that we were all expected to do our part. Then Donald Trump came along, and none of what we argued for seemed to apply anymore. Since 2016, we have seen an anarchic American populace lose its grasp on reality. We have watched courts of law succumb to partisan politics. We have stumbled through the day as medical professionals rejected science, our most trusted advisors became vilified, and our peace officers warned us that civil war might be right around the corner. Political philosophers became as untethered as everyone else, who was forced to admit that everything is up for grabs in Donald Trump's America. Now, I want you to notice something. First of all, that I did not take a position on how someone should feel about Trump or on which side of the divide they should be. The great unmooring is evident whether you believe that Republicans are authoritarians giving in to a false messiah or Democrats all suffer what the former president calls Trump derangement syndrome. The failures of our institutions are equally terrifying, whether you think that Justices Thomas and Alito are bought and paid for by billionaire puppeteers, or you regard Special Counsel Jack Smith as President Biden's attack dog. My point isn't that there's a right or wrong, but rather that wherever you sit, it's always the other people who bring the crazy. There is then a second thing I want you to notice. A lot of the conflict America is burdened by depends on competing notions of what it means to be good and just in the first place. What does it mean to treat people equally? Who deserves a seat at the table? How much freedom is morally acceptable? In the conflict between government and citizens, who rightly coerces whom? It isn't enough for us to choose a horse in the race. We need to consider what our fellow Americans imagine the track they're racing on to look like. Nobody seems to agree on what we're fighting for. Now, hold on, you might interpret. Don't take it too far. Surely we disagree about laws and candidates, but we all want the same things, don't we? We may disagree on details, but aren't we all trying to build a better democracy? This is where it gets complicated. Because, well, to quote the great Inigo Montoya, you keep using that word. I do not think it means what you think it means. Democracy is not just majority rule. It's not just a method for choosing who leads us. It's a complex system that has within it its own standards of success. It brings with it a definition of equality and a way of checking to see if we've realized it or not. A particular conception of self-rule that lets us test whether our leaders are responsive enough. A prerequisite for basic knowledge that undermines our nation's legitimacy if the voters don't actually understand how the government works. In other words, in light of our current fight for electoral dominance, we really need to step back and ask what values we are insisting that everyone else lives by. That's what we're going to do on today's episode. With our guest, we're going to articulate what our democratic values actually are and examine real-world behavior to see what has fallen short and why. We're going to consider the role of moneyed business interests, the unfettered political behavior of our politicians, voters' motives, and the general populace's political understanding to ask two adjacent questions. How is America working, and how should it work? This happens less often than we might think because it's much easier to get angry than it is to get philosophical. Before we move ahead, though, I'd like to ask everyone to suspend their political loyalties for the time being. Why Radio is and always has been a nonpartisan show, but at the same time, we have insisted on following arguments to their logical conclusions. Regardless of our guest, regardless of our topic, we strive to be neutral, curious, and courageous, and we aim to be trustworthy enough that our listeners can do the same without fear of being ambushed or politically manipulated. This episode may be one of the harder ones to manage because the political issues we are discussing are raw and powerful. Let's put aside our fear of losing, whatever that might mean, and consider the possibility that we still have things to learn. It's 2024. an election year in the United States, and there has never been a more important time to think of our fellow citizens as philosophical partners. Democracy is, in many respects, a political system that asks more questions than it answers. Let's see if we can explore these unknowns as allies rather than competitors, not as enemies, but as friends. And now our guest. Adam Lovett is a lecturer at Australian Catholic University and a former fellow at the London School of Economics. His most recent book is called Democratic Failures and the Ethics of Democracy. Adam, welcome to Why.
Great to be here. I'm looking forward to talking about this material.
To our listeners, if you'd like to participate, please share your favorite moments from the show and tag us on social networks. Our handle is always at Why Radio Show. Rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or your preferred podcast platform so that others can find the show and listen to all 15 years worth of episodes for free, as well as our sister show, Philosophical Currents, at our website, whyradioshow.org. That's whyradioshow.org. And as always, the show can only happen with your support. We exist solely on listener contributions. So please click donate in the upper right-hand corner of our website to make your tax-deductible donation through the University of North Dakota Alumni Foundation portal. All right, with business done, Adam, your book starts off with an admission that American democracy in particular is failing. As I mentioned in my monologue, I think most people would agree, but they'd probably wave their hand in disgust and focus on something else. Is it really a foregone conclusion that American democracy is, let's say, unhealthy? And why do you think we need to talk about it as philosophers as opposed to pundits or talking heads?
So a great question. I mean, whether it's a foregone conclusion, I think no, which is why I wrote the book, because I wanted to kind of evaluate whether that conclusion is correct. So I'm going to focus on, you know, why should philosophers talk about this? And I think there are two main reasons. So first, I think kind of accurate diagnosis of what actually ails American democracy is extremely valuable. So your monologue started in the kind of 2016 and the rise of Trump and the kind of polarization-induced decay of American institutions that became really acute during that period. But I actually think the problems with American democracy go back much further than that, and are much more kind of widespread and intractable. So these are problems of kind of deep voter ignorance, of weak kind of popular control over politicians, of, you know, the influence of money in politics. So these are not kind of a recent phenomena, they're a much more long-standing phenomena. And noticing that makes us realize, one, that they're also not kind of America-specific phenomena in many cases. In some cases, they are, for instance, the polarization is a feature of the US, but less so of, say, Germany. But, you know, features like voter ignorance, for example, are not kind of US specific. So I think diagnosing exactly what these problems are is extremely valuable for kind of understanding the political systems we live in, and also valuable, of course, for kind of providing solutions to those problems. But the second reason why I think kind of dwelling on these issues from a philosophical perspective is really important is that I think the failure of our political systems to kind of live up to democratic ideals really matters for the rights and duties of ordinary citizens. So I think in a well-functioning democracy, people like you and I have kind of these weighty moral obligations to obey the laws. We've got weighty obligations to participate in politics, to vote, for example. I think there are constraints, moral constraints on how we're allowed to participate in politics, how we're allowed to compete to try and win power, for instance. But these kind of moral norms, these moral constraints or obligations, all come from a political system that achieves democratic values to a high degree. So I think the discovery that the US, for instance, really doesn't achieve these values to a high degree isn't just something we can, like, you know, throw up our hands at and move on to the next thing, something that really matters to the ethics of democracy, to the rights and obligations of ordinary people like us, where we have duties to obey law, for example. So I think those two reasons really are what motivates kind of philosophical investigation of these issues.
I have to ask, because you mentioned it's not just the U.S., that there are other countries and that we're going to talk about, and we're going to talk about an ideal democracy at the same time. Judging by your accent, you are not from the United States. That's not a Kentucky accent that I hear. So I guess the first question that I have is, why did you choose America? And as a non-American, do you think that there are things that you can see that others can't? And do you think that a lot of people are correct when they say that America is sort of the standard democracy that we're comparing other countries to? Because a lot of people, when they're defending America in the face of criticism, they'll say America is the shining city on the hill. America is a model for all countries in the world. And there are lots of people also who are skeptical of that. So as a non-American, what do you see that we don't, and how do you value the American experience?
Yeah, okay. So I'll tell you why I chose America. So I lived in the United States for many years, for about 6 years before moving to London and then Australia. The reason to focus on the US are kind of twofold. One, the United States is an extremely important case. Everybody should think that. The US is the world's second largest democracy, debatably the world's oldest democracy. The politics of the US are really important for the rest of the world. Second, we actually just know a lot more about how American democracy functions than we do about how, say, you know, Indian democracy or Australian democracy or even British democracy functions. That's just because the lion's share of the world's political scientists live in the United States, and so they study the US disproportionately, and that gives us a much deeper understanding of, like, voter behavior, how policy works in the US. So that's why kind of my focus has been on the states. How good how good a case study is the states is like a kind of example to other nations. So I don't think the US is a kind of like a standard form of democracy or anything like that. The US has very specific institutions, presidential institutions, this first past the post electoral system. It has this specific history of, say, fraught race relations, but also like enormous global power. And these all make the United States kind of extremely distinctive when compared to many other democracies, for instance, you know, democracies like Italy or Germany or India, for example. So it's not like we should think that the US kind of provides some like kind of standard, normative standard, or obviously extends to these other cases. On the other hand, what I do think is that many of the issues that arise in the United States do arise in very many other democracies as well. So, you know, I mentioned polarization before. So the US, as we all know, has become extraordinarily polarized over the last kind of 20 to 30 years. But actually, US polarization in global perspective is not that much of an outlier. The US is, no, as far as we can tell, looks no more polarized than, say, Spain or Switzerland or something like that. Many other countries, not all countries, but many other countries also face severe polarization. And other features that are prominent in the US, like the fact that kind of, you know, voters don't know much about politics, or often when they reason about politics, bend the evidence to show their side in the best possible light. That's just very clearly not a feature distinctive of the states. It's not like kind of American voters know less about politics than German voters or Canadian voters or Mexican voters. In many cases, they know more. Rather, the truth of the matter is voters in every large democracy don't know much about politics. So the takeaway there is many of the phenomena that you can see very clearly in the US because of the enormous amount of empirical work on American politics do generalize quite broadly.
How much of a benchmark do we need when we're trying to describe how well a democracy functions? And I'll explain what I mean by that. Especially in the political philosophy tradition, the first great work on political philosophy, Plato's Republic, sets up an ideal city, a city in speech, as he says. And the goal for Plato was to look at other regimes and other ways of doing politics and compare with the idea of getting as close to that ideal as possible. Aristotle thought that you didn't need to compare something to an ideal, but you did need to compare it with like kind. So he had this whole study of constitutions and would compare this constitution to that constitution to that constitution. In other words, political analysis, even on the philosophical level, has always leaned towards the comparative, that you need a benchmark in order to know what you're striving for. Is that true? Do we need to have an ideal vision of what a democracy is to know whether the democracy is working well or not?
I think the answer to that is yes and no. So mainly no. So I don't think we need a kind of a picture of an ideal democracy in order to evaluate kind of when one democracy is better than another or kind of how well our democracies are doing. I think a more fruitful way to approach it, to approach matters in terms of thinking about democratic values, so what makes democracy kind of valuable in itself or intrinsically valuable. So some people think democracies are valuable because they have good causal consequences, but I think they're also valuable in themselves. So I think democracy is valuable because it helps realize, on the one hand, autonomy, citizen authorship of government affairs, and on the other hand, equality, equal distributions of power among citizens. So these values are kind of things that can be realized to different degrees. And when we focus on these values, we can kind of assess, do our actual political systems, like the United States, for example, do they realize these values to any substantial degree, or do they not realize these values to any substantial degree? When we're comparing different political systems, what sets of institutions realize these values to a greater and a lesser degree? So we can focus on the kind of underlying normative values without having to really lay out what kind of constitution, for example, would help realize a value to a maximal degree.
I want to call attention to something that you said in the beginning of that answer, because I think it's really important, and I'd like our listeners to focus on it for a second, which is, you said that there are some people who will want to value democracy in terms of its consequences, how it turns out. You know, are people wealthier? Are people happier? Is life more predictable? But there's something in a democracy that is, and you keep using the philosophical word normative, meaning that it's morally obligatory, and that there are values in a democracy that make democracy good in itself. Could you talk a little bit more about that, a little bit what it means for something to be good in itself, and why it steps away from that comparative model, and why you can look inward to see whether something is working or not? What does it mean for something to be good in itself?
So think about pleasure or friendship. These have good consequences. Relationships you have with your friends, you know, cause you pleasure, cause you to be happy, to have good times. But I think those friendships are not only valuable because they have good consequences, they're also intrinsically valuable. They'd be valuable, their value kind of is detached from their good consequences. And I think we should think of democracy similarly. It's not only good because it maybe averts famine or causes economic growth or reduces the risk of war. Maybe it does those things. But it's also valuable in itself. And why you should think that is, well, you should think about Singapore, or you should think about a benevolent dictatorship. So imagine we could identify some guy who would be way better at enacting policies than we are ourselves democratically. That means he'd enact much better policies than we would by voting on it. We'd have some reason to install this person as a dictator over us, because after all, it'd be great to have perfect policy. But I think we'd also have weighty reason to resist the dictatorship of this person. Now, that in this hypothetical case wouldn't be, you know, instrumental reason, because by hypothesis, kind of installing this person as a dictator would have great consequences. Rather, we lose something intrinsically valuable about democracy if we gave up on it, if we kind of move to this benevolent dictatorship. And that's the kind of idea that motivates the thought that democracy is not only kind of valuable for its good causal consequences, valuable for other reasons as well. In other words, it's kind of intrinsically valuable.
So democracy is an achievement in itself, right? When Aristotle says we all want to be happy, the answer why that is because happiness is good and we want to be happy because we want to be happy, that there's nowhere else to go. And so all else being equal, if you had a dictatorship and a democracy which had the same consequences, you could still say that the democracy is better because the democracy is the achievement that we are striving for. The democracy is what allows us to be who we are better than any other option. And so I guess the next question is, what are the cornerstone values that you think democracy is hooked onto? Why is it a good in itself? What is it that we can look at within the theory of democracy that we can say, oh, here is a particularly good human virtue. Oh, this is a particularly good human virtue. Oh, this is humanity at its best. This is an individual acting at their finest. What is it that a democracy brings to the table that allows it to be an achievement in and of itself?
Well, I'm glad you asked. So I think there are two kind of core intrinsic values to democracy, equality and autonomy. So when it comes to equality, I think relationships are objectionably inegalitarian. So think here of kind of the relationship of a master to their slave or a lord to their peasant in like feudal Europe, or the relationship between husband and wife in a patriarchal marriage, say in Victorian Britain. I think these relationships are relationships of subordination and domination, and they're intrinsically objectionable. That means people have a claim against being subjected to these relationships. And these relationships are constituted by asymmetries of power. What it is to be subordinated to someone is to be subject to their asymmetric power. So I think one of the reasons democracy is intrinsically valuable is that it helps preclude these power asymmetries. In democracies, at least in principle, everyone has equal political power, because after all, we all have one vote. That helps reduce these asymmetries of power, and so helps us avoid these kind of intrinsically objectionable relationships of subordination or domination. But I don't think that exhausts what makes democracy valuable. I think there's a second aspect democracy's value, which is in democracies we rule ourselves. We have kind of autonomous authorship of government policy and of the important features of our environment. And to get a grip on this value, I want you to think about your personal life. I think it's really valuable for you to be the one who decides who you marry or where you live or what career you pursue. It's valuable for you to be the kind of autonomous author of your individual affairs, and analogously, I think it's valuable for us collectively, a collection of citizens, to be autonomous author of our social and political affairs. That means kind of the important features of our society, the shape of our economic system, how our society treats criminals, this kind of thing. I think when we're autonomous author of our social and political affairs, we get the same kind of value as when we're autonomous author of our individual affairs. Democracy can facilitate such autonomous authorship of our social and political affairs, because to be author of anything, you have to have a causal influence on that thing. You're not author of who you marry if someone else arranges your marriage for you and you don't get a say. Similarly, to be author of kind of government policy, we have to have a causal influence on it, and democracy allows us to have that causal influence. So these two values, equality and autonomy, I think are central to democracy's intrinsic value.
Okay, after the break, we're going to come back to that because there's a lot in there that we need to unpack. And of course, it also plays a core role in investigating the vibrancy of a democracy. But for the moment, you are listening to Adam Lovett and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Adam Lovett about his book, Democratic Failures and the Ethics of Democracy. We're asking the question, is American democracy failing? And before we get back, I want to talk about something for a second, because a lot of long-term listeners will be used to me talking about my daughter. I've used examples over the years. She was about two when the show started. Well, she took a gap year from high school, and she's been accepted into university. And in a couple months, she's off, and I'm super excited. She got she went to her first choice university. And it's a very interesting time, because both in terms of my wife and I, but also in terms of watching our friends, it's a very good time to ask if we have been good parents, if we have succeeded in doing what we're doing. And it's very easy to compare in terms of what college they got into. Does this person go to the number one school of this, or are they a brand name that? And my wife and I are both educators. We're very skeptical of the elite institutions. And so we don't want to be competitive when we ask whether they're good parents. We want to look inward, and we want to ask questions like, is Adina a kind person? Can she make good decisions for herself? Is she doing something that makes her feel fulfilled? We're asking these questions because it helps us step outside of our immediate feelings to get something objective. I bring this up because I think Adam is having us do something similarly. We don't ask, does America have the best GDP? We ask, can American citizens make decisions for themselves? Do they govern themselves? Are they autonomous? We don't ask, does America defeat other countries in war? We ask, do Americans have equal participation in the discussion? The goal, when you're trying to analyze something in and of itself, is to find those benchmarks and to keep going back to them so you don't confuse the issue. So I guess as we start to look at the empirical questions, Adam, I want to ask you, how hard is it when you're looking at the democratic literature, when you're looking at stuff about voting rights, when you're looking at the news, how hard is it to go back to these questions of equality and autonomy? Is it difficult to keep yourself rooted in that theoretical foundation, or does it just come easily?
Well, I'd say it takes some practice, you know, it comes easily after many years. I mean, I think kind of, you know, I was talking about equality and autonomy a moment ago. Really what I was saying there was kind of very abstract. You know, I gave these very abstract descriptions of these values, really. I think it is very hard and takes a lot of work to connect these abstract descriptions of these values to things actually going on in everyday politics. And that requires, well, it requires practice, but also just kind of hard work and care and like mindfulness about it.
When you read a news story, let's say you read a news story about the Republicans arguing and, you know, trying to pass an anti-abortion measure. The details are not important. And they say, this is what our constituents want. You know, we are a conduit for our constituents. We are only responding in the way that people want. Can you analyze that in terms of these core values, equality and self-rule? Can you look at the individual politicians' decisions and test them to see if that means the democracy is working or not?
So I think the answer is to some extent. So take the case you gave of abortion policy. What constituents want is one important consideration that bears on abortion policy, as on any other policy domain. It's an important consideration because it connects to this autonomy-based aspect of democracy's value. Generally speaking, we want to give citizens what they want because we want them to be kind of autonomous authors of their affairs. And in fact, we don't just want to give them what they want. We want them to bring about what they want via kind of voting and selecting legislators to pass the kind of laws they want. So I think that that sort of consideration really tells in favour of policies I might not agree with in some cases when my opinions differ from a popular opinion. But it's not the only issue, of course. Democratic values are one extremely important kind of value, but I think there are other values. I think people have various rights, and you know, voting to strip people of rights is a morally objectionable thing to do. I think in many cases these kind of claims about public opinion are contentious. So I think right now in the US, so I think these kind of democratic issues really bear on these political questions, but aren't always kind of decisive.
So I'm going to ask the same question in a different way, because as the host, I was trying to subtly lead you to a particular answer, and I was too subtle. So I'm going to ask it in a different way, and I want you to sort of explain what I mean by that. The answer that I thought you were going to give was, in an ideal democracy, we could very conveniently say that politicians are acting on the will of the people. But in the American democracy, we can't do that because there is very little popular control. And who the politicians listen to, it isn't as simple as their constituents. A, am I interpreting your book correctly? And B, can you explain what I mean by that to talk about the idea of popular control?
Yeah, you are interpreting the book correctly. Like, I previous answer was bracketing these empirical issues. So yeah, whenever a politician says that, you know, they're enacting some policy because it's popular among their constituents and appeal to democratic values in order to defend the legitimacy of that policy, the sort of how I see things is that the argument there is this argument that, like, look, ordinary people should really be authors of our social and political affairs. And so if, in the words you used, if a politician really just is the conduit of public opinion, then there is kind of good reason to support them in enacting the policies that public opinion kind of supports. Then the empirical question is whether that is in fact true, and specifically whether the public opinion is the right kind of opinion to really have this kind of moral or normative weight. And I think there are many reasons to doubt that that is very common in the United States. So one reason to doubt that concerns the weak popular control kind of constituents have over representatives. So what that means is, generally speaking, in the US, representatives respond much more to their own supporters than their kind of constituents writ large. So if you get a kind of a Democrat in a who's elected in a constituency, they're going to respond mainly to their Democratic supporters, the Democrats in their constituency, rather than Republicans. Same goes for Republican politicians. So they will not, generally speaking, be kind of representing the entirety of their constituents. But maybe more important for the issue of kind of authorship of government policy is that it's often very hard to see how citizens' preferences over policy are the right kind of preferences for them really to be autonomous authors of policy. Why that is that most of us don't know very much about policies. Most of us in the ballot booth, one, we're not kind of driven by our policy preferences. Our policy preferences aren't kind of determining our vote. Other factors are, for instance, kind of group identities or maybe assessments of the trustworthiness of politicians or their past performance in office. And even if we are driven by policy preferences, we often don't even know the policy positions of the different candidates or parties. We certainly don't know the effects of those policies. I think that all makes it very hard to kind of make autonomous choices in the ballot booth. But that means that it's generally speaking not the case that the policies a specific politician is defending or enacting or trying to enact, it's generally speaking not the case that those are the expression of this kind of these kind of autonomous intentions or autonomous authorship on behalf of their constituents, because most of us ordinary citizens are kind of not made of the right kind of stuff to really see our preferences autonomously manifest in government policy. So all that kind of casts a bit of doubt on this line of thought.
So tell me if I get this right. So you have a representative who votes a certain way. And when you want to ask who they are voting for, right, what's motivating them to vote this particular way, there are a bunch of complications. The first is that if they are a Democrat, they're mainly going to listen to other Democrats. If they're a Republican, they're mainly going to listen to other Republicans. But when they listen to, I'll stick with Democrats for a second, when they listen to Democrats, they're actually only going to listen to the rich Democrats. And when they look at the rich Democrats, they're largely going to look at the highest donors rather than the people who have money. And even then, when we're looking at the highest donors, they're going to look at the business interests because they have the biggest lobbyists and all of that sort of thing. So on one hand, there's all these exclusionary steps. On the other hand, we look at the constituents, and the constituents don't really understand the issues. And even if they understood the issues, they're not really clear on what position the representative holds. And even if they're clear on what the position the representative holds, they don't really know the process by which they can get this opinion through the legislative process and the laws. And so tell me if I'm right here. When we complain that democracy isn't working because a representative, quote, voted the wrong way, there's not one issue. It's not the idea that they just voted the wrong way. It's that we have to look at economic inequality to fix this. We have to look at person-to-person inequality in order to fix it. We have to look at whether a corporation is a person in order to fix it. We also have to look at education in order to fix it. We have to look at people's awareness of current events in order to fix it. So the very simple problem of the representative voting the wrong way is itself the consequence of a massive systemic failure that we have to address on 5, 6, 7 different levels. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, that's totally right. Representatives often do not vote for the most popular policies, but that is probably causally related to the fact that voters also don't vote in favor of candidates with policies they support. Voters are driven by loads of other things and often aren't informed enough to vote in favour of candidates they support. So this kind of causal system is what leads to these kind of shortfalls in democratic values. I'd say the one kind of amendment I'd make to the story you sketched is that I'd say when thinking about how representatives act, how a president acts, or how a congressperson acts, I think the main thing we should think is that, you know, these people are autonomous people with their own policy preferences. Primarily, they just try and enact their own policy preferences of things they think will be advantageous to them, or things they think will be advantageous to the country. And in that sense, they're not. We shouldn't think of these people as puppeteered by wealthy interests. We should think that insofar as they are influenced by kind of people other than themselves, they're influenced, as you said, by their own supporters and also by their own donors and also by their own business interests, which kind of align with them and all these things. But generally speaking, we should think of them as kind of policymakers as fairly autonomous beings, I think. That's causally connected to these claims about or these facts about voter behavior.
So that's a great example because it allows us to go back to the beginning of our conversation. What you're saying is that we we can think about representatives as conduits or as acting on the voice of their constituents, but actually they're not. They're people with their own interests and their own preferences, and they're going to act in a certain way, which gives us an equality problem, right? It means that representatives are not equal in power to citizens, and therefore representatives are going to get their preferences met as opposed to the people who voted for them. And so if you're going to look at this in a theoretical framework, it's the first foundational point that we talked about, that this is an equality problem. Why? Why is it an equality problem, and why is it bad, quote unquote, for a representative to have more power than, say, a voter?
So yeah, I claimed at the start of this conversation that there were these two core democratic values, equality and autonomy. The autonomy stuff is mainly undermined by voter behavior, our weak grasp of policy, and our apathy about policy issues. But as you said, I think the problem when it comes to representatives' autonomy, the fact that representatives aren't under kind of popular control, is a quality problem, as you just said. And here's the picture. So I said earlier that democracy is valuable in part because it helps preclude these asymmetries of power, right? And these asymmetries of power are bad because relationships characterized by asymmetric power, like the relationship of master to slave or lord to peasant, are kind of intrinsically objectionable relationships, relationships of subordination. And in democracies, we all have one vote, so we all have equal power. So that's clearly not true in any contemporary democracy, because in all contemporary democracies, we actually elect representatives who enact policy. Representatives are the ones who make the laws, who determine the workings of the state, who oversee government. So they have enormously more power than ordinary citizens. So on the face of it, these kind of representative democracies don't really realize or don't really achieve these egalitarian aspects of democracy's value. So I think there is a way in principle to solve that kind of tension between equality and representative democracy. The way to resolve that tension is to put representatives under popular control. What that means is to ensure that representatives are kind of constrained to do what their constituents want. And the basic idea here is that if I have a lot of power over you, but how I use that power is under external control, then my kind of power over you is not objectionable. The kind of external control saps the problem with that power. So I think this in principle is the way to reconcile representative democracy with equality. The issue is that in practice, in many democracies, the US most obviously, this kind of mechanism for resolving this challenge to representative democracy doesn't work very well, because as I just discussed, representatives aren't really under very tight popular control. They're kind of generally they do what they want. They're autonomous kind of policymakers. Sometimes they listen to their own supporters. Sometimes they listen to wealthy individuals, but largely they're independent. And so this kind of egalitarian objection to representative democracy, to empowering these people over us, kind of stands because of the failure of the mechanism of popular control. So that's why it's an equality problem.
So we're talking about two different kinds of democracy here. We're alluding to direct democracy, in which citizens vote themselves on particular issues or legislation, and we see that in popular referenda and initiatives. But we have a representative democracy in which we choose someone to make those decisions for us because we think we share values with them. And so the problem with the representative democracy is that the representatives aren't representative enough, that they're representing themselves, to keep using the term, and they're speaking for themselves. And that's what makes it an equality problem, because that means that people are unequal. There's an autonomy problem too. So will you tell us what you mean by autonomy, what autonomy means politically, and then explain why it's an autonomy problem. Because, well, I'll say why I want us to talk about that in just a second. Mm-hmm. What does autonomy mean, and why is it and why is there a problem?
So by autonomy, I mean the kind of authorship of these important features of our society. And I think we can really get a grip on what's valuable here by thinking about authorship of things in your personal life. The case I used before is it's really valuable for you to be the one to decide who you marry. Why? Because that makes you a self-author, author of your own life. Similarly, I think it's valuable for citizens to be the ones to decide the shape of our economic system, because that makes us author of this kind of crucially important feature of our social affairs. How do we become author of these features? Well, for a start, we need to be able to make a causal contribution to them. That means we need to be able to have some impact on what our economic system looks like, or on or our immigration policy, or how much our government spends on welfare benefits or social security or something like that. There needs to be a causal connection between what citizens want and what the government does in order for citizens to really count as offering these important government policies. But the problem is that merely the existence of a causal connection between what citizens want and what government does isn't sufficient to really autonomously author government policy. And you can see that again in personal cases. So merely being a causal connection between your choices and what happens in your life isn't sufficient for you to be kind of in a position to make an autonomous choice. One really important other kind of necessary condition for you to make an autonomous choice is you need to know about your options. You need to understand your different options. So if you're kind of deciding between two careers, say you're deciding whether to be a banker or a academic, but you've got no idea what either of these careers amounts to. You've got no idea that being a banker means high pay but long hours, and being an academic means like lots of intellectual freedom but little control over where you live. If you've got no idea of these facts, then you're not able to make an autonomous career choice. Equally, if voters don't have much idea about what the different options are they're faced with in the ballot booth, they don't know, say, the policies of the different candidates or what impact those policies will have, they're not able to make autonomous choices in the ballot booth. And generally speaking, we know from by now about 70 years of kind of political science, from surveyors going out and asking voters factual questions about politics, about how our institutions work, about what policies different parties have, the voters do lack this knowledge. That means that our kind of ignorance, it's kind of widespread political ignorance, undermines our ability to make autonomous choices in the ballot booth, and so undermines our ability to be kind of these autonomous authors of our social and political affairs. So that's kind of the nature of autonomy and why, and the kind of challenges it faces in a large democracy like the United States.
So anyone who spends time with young people in the United States will know that they're having a hard time being excited about the coming election, that they don't look at any of the candidates and say, first of all, that they represent them, but second of all, that they can look back at the decisions that either Donald Trump made or either Joe Biden and say, I did that. That's my voice. I chose that. And that young people who want to get excited about democracy need to be able to look at all of the decisions and say, this is me. That the representative wrote that law or voted for that law, but they were doing that because I feel this way. I made that choice. I had that idea. And I think this is, Adam, what you're talking about in terms of autonomy, that to be autonomous is to be able to look at a governmental decision and say, that was me. I feel like I contributed. I feel like I helped write that. I feel like I was the author of that. And so at the core of this discussion is this hypothesis that if we are going to ask whether American democracy fails, we shouldn't look at whether Republicans get their preferences or whether Democrats get their preferences, that we need to ask whether or not people are really equal and really engage in self-government. Are they really autonomous? That the question, is American democracy failing, isn't a policy question at all, which is what everyone thinks it is, but rather it's a question about the place of the individual in society. So again, I'm going to ask you, is my interpretation correct that part of what you're saying is we have been looking at the wrong thing? To answer the question, is American democracy failing or succeeding, we have to look at Americans and their relationships with each other and their relationships with the law, as opposed to what the policies and laws and consequences are. Am I right that we're looking at the wrong place?
Yeah, so I think that's right, Jack. So I want to connect this back to our previous discussion of instrumental versus intrinsic democratic values. So when we are looking at kind of the policy output of the American government, is it passing good policies or not? And when we're evaluating US government on those metrics, we're really thinking of democracy in purely instrumental terms. We're trying to work out whether the political system has good effects or not. But I think that's an extremely incomplete analysis of any political system, certainly of any democratic political system. We also have to evaluate these systems in intrinsic terms by whether they realize these twin values of equality and autonomy. And to do that, it's not sufficient and not even a good start to look at how good the policy outputs are. You know, is it good to have 100% tariffs on electric cars from China or not? Really, to do that, we have to look at how policy is made, the procedures and the nature of voters, how voters behave, what they know, how they interact with one another, and how those interactions mold the behavior of legislators and presidents.
I want to take a step back and I want to ask a very basic question. What motivates voters? What motivates people to support a candidate or to support a policy? We've been taught all along that it's just self-interest, that people just want to do what they think is right for them, except for a very small core of issues like, again, abortion for folks on the right and, let's say, welfare of folks on the left, where there are a couple core issues where people think about helping others. But mostly, voters are self-interested individuals who are supposed to choose the person that best represents them. Is that really what motivates the voter? Are people just, they know what they want, they're going to pick the right person to get it, and they're going to choose that person because that's what they want?
Yeah, so I think the self-interest story you have in mind to some extent over-intellectualizes voters. So the self-interest story you have in mind, or at least one version of this story, kind of thinks of voters as looking at the different policies candidates support, trying to work out which policies will be best for them, and then voting for the candidate with those policies. So this story often depicts voters as kind of issue-based, albeit self-interestedly issue-based. The more fundamental problem with that story, more fundamental than whether kind of voters are more altruistic or self-interested, is that by and large, voters are not being driven by these policy considerations at all. We know that because, for a start, you can go out and ask voters why they voted the way they did. When you do this, and these studies last been done in the mid to kind of 2000s, 2004 and 2008, after the respective elections in those years, fewer than kind of 20% of voters even mention policy issues as salient for why they voted the way they did, and fewer than 10% of voters kind of give any detailed description of the policies the different parties have and why that led them to vote the way they did. There's a bunch of other evidence that suggests that voters by and large are not being influenced by policy issues self-interestedly or altruistically. Rather, voters are being influenced partly by kind of performance assessments. So what that means is if the economy is doing well, voters will often vote for incumbents. If it's doing badly, they'll vote against incumbents. But also very substantially, voters are motivated by kind of group identities. So here, think of Catholics voting for Kennedy in the 60s or Black people voting for Obama 10 years ago. Here, voters were motivated by religious or racial identities, respectively. And of course, in the contemporary United States, partisan identity is by far the most important identity. People identify as Democrat or identify as Republican. And this is the dominant influence on why people vote the way they do. Democrats vote for Democrats, Republicans vote for Republicans. This isn't really kind of, we shouldn't think of that as kind of Democrats having like a set of policy preferences that leads them to be kind of Democratic voters or Republicans for that matter. Rather, we should think of these partisan identities as things people get in childhood from their parents and from friends and other social contexts. And then things that kind of just pervasively affect our political behavior in a kind of irrational way through our lives. So really we should think of voters not as these kind of self-interested issue voters, but rather as much more irrational kind of group identity voters, to some extent kind of performance voters, kind of people driven by like local environmental, say, economic conditions.
This is such an instructive observation, and I think it's really important to spend another couple minutes on this, because it's really something that's playing out in the current election, and it's something actually that the Republicans do a lot better than the Democrats. What they understand is that the question that people are asking themselves is not this policy or that policy, but am I a good Republican? Do my neighbors see me as a good Republican? If I'm a good Republican, I have to be a pro-life voter. I have to be a pro-gun rights voter. I have to be all these things, because that's what a good Republican does. And a good Democrat does analogous things. And so this is another problem in the American democracy, right? There's the first problem is that people aren't equal. The second problem is that people aren't able to self-govern. But the third problem is that people are identity voters rather than issue voters. And since you're voting for an identity, you are then voting for a person and their affiliation, not getting the legislation that you necessarily feel strongly about, because you don't necessarily know what that legislation is. So the question I guess I want to ask you is, first of all, is a democratic citizen in itself an identity? Is an American an identity? And why is it that Republican identity, the identity of a Republican, the identity as a Democrat, the identity as a liberal or a lefty or a right winger or a MAGA person, why are these so important? Why are people attached to their identity so much?
So I think one thing you have to understand is most people, even today in 2024 America, don't care that much about politics. So of course, kind of politicians we see on the news or kind of activists, you know, people whose political behavior is reported, they care enormously about politics. People who consume a lot of political media might care a lot about politics. But by and large, most people don't care that much about politics. You know, turnout in the States at midterms is still only about 40% or something like that. So really, you don't need kind of political identities to be this kind of thing people care enormously about in order to them to matter enormously to this one choice people by and large make every 4 years. These can matter enormously to voting behaviour, even when they don't loom large in people's psychology outside of the ballot booth. And so they can matter enormously to whether we're able to achieve democratic values, even when they don't matter enormously to whether we're able to achieve kind of personal values in our lives outside of politics. So that's one important thing to understand. But what is true, I think, is that these kind of partisan identities have become much, much more important to Americans over time. Why that seems to be the case is because these partisan identities started to align more with people's other identities. So over the last kind of 30 to 40 years, religion, race, gender, economic position have aligned much more closely with party identities than they did in, say, the 1970s. And when these party identities become a summary of these kind of large number of other identities, these religious or racial identities, say, then they become much more potent to people's self-understanding. They become much more important factors driving people's behaviour. So what I want to say in response to your question about why these things are important, that one, they don't need to be that important to people's everyday lives to be massively important to their political lives. But why they are growing in importance is because of this kind of coherence between party identity and these other identities.
Implicit in that answer, I mean, the answer is a great answer, and it really highlights something that is going to tie the whole conversation together. And it rests on the thing that you said, that people just don't care that much about politics. When democracy was first invented and then it was refined, there was this notion of citizenship. The Greeks thought the citizen was the ideal person. And even the Enlightenment folks in the 18th century thought that being a citizen was something incredibly important that a person had to realize. But if people don't care about being a citizen, they need to have something else fill up that hole of identity. And so it's becoming, being a Catholic fills up that hole. Being Black fills up that hole. Being, I don't know, a Mason fills up that hole. And that since the 1970s, even our party affiliation, which we could use as a stand-in for citizen, is becoming less important. So the reason why these identities drive people is that it's the thing that people care about. It's the thing that people want to be judged in terms of their Blackness, their whiteness, their maleness, their gayness, other such things. Do we have to reconceive democracy based on identity politics and away from individualism? Is the lesson of the changing notions of identity that democracy as an aggregate of individuals who are all trying to make the best decisions, is that obsolete? And we have to rethink and reconceive of democracy as a democracy of groups as opposed to a democracy of individuals?
So I think the answer to that is largely yes. So this is a kind of descriptive question, really, about how should we actually understand democratic politics? What's actually driving individuals in democracies? And I think kind of the best way to understand a lot of democratic politics is in terms of group behavior. Humans are group animals, we're social animals, and that affects how we participate in politics. And it's not like this is new, you know, like people sometimes describe identity politics as something that was invented by the Democratic Party in like the 70s or something like this, or 80s. But that's just not really the case. Just kind of extremely common throughout American history and throughout the history of other countries, that people are driven by religious identities, driven by racial identities, ethnic identities, kind of social identities. Are they a worker, for example? Are they in a union? Or are they a factory owner? All these things just have an enormous influence on how we behave across a wide range of domains, including in politics. And I think to really understand mass politics, the politics of democracies in a large, of democracy in a large country like the United States, a country of 350 million people, is to think that voters by and large are going to be driven by these group identities. Then the normative question is that compatible with achieving kind of anything that makes democracy intrinsically valuable or not?
Please explain what that question means, and then what your intuitive answer is.
Yeah, so that question is, if it's the case that we shouldn't think of kind of each individual as, you know, being kind of fully informed about politics and making their own decisions independent of others and voting on policy, is that consistent with, and should instead think of them as largely driven by collection of kind of group identities, is that compatible with democracy realizing these values of equality and autonomy I talked about earlier? And I think the answer is partially. So I think that this understanding of democratic politics makes it very hard to achieve kind of this autonomous authorship of government policy. Because if we're not voting on the basis of our policy preferences, but are rather voting on a basis of group identities, and our policy preferences aren't making that causal contribution to what the government actually does, and so we can't be author of what the government actually does. So this kind of way of, kind of this kind of discovery about how democratic politics works does pose an enormous barrier to the achievement of this kind of autonomy aspect of democracy value. But I think it's kind of compatible with the achievement of democratic equality. Democratic equality, after all, is just about getting rid of asymmetries of power, achieving kind of equal power relationships between citizens. The fact that voters aren't voting on policy, the fact that they're voting on group identities rather than what they want the government to do, doesn't necessarily mean that our societies are going to be riven by power asymmetries. We can still have an egalitarian political community, despite these kind of facts, if they are facts, about voter behaviour. So that's partly what I mean by kind of getting really clear on what's wrong with kind of certain aspects of American democracy. It can help us understand kind of what can be salvaged, what we can hope for when we hope to improve a democracy like the United States.
So your argument is that the failures of democracy can't be addressed until we really understand that the problem is in realizing these core values, these core virtues, that we have to look at what we mean by equality and how to realize that. We have to look at what we mean by autonomy or self-rule and how to realize that. We have to look at what it means to be the author of laws before we realize it. So in short, we have to be philosophers before we have to be politicians. We have to think theoretically before we think empirically. Is there anything, as we conclude, that we need to think about doing practically? Do you have any recommendations or any things that you think we can do first and foremost to start the process of shoring up our democracy and making it something that will last for a long time and be morally valuable?
Yeah, so I think there is a number of institutional reforms the United States could make that would most likely better achieve democratic values. So in many cases, the USR is very hard to see these reforms happening, but, you know, we live in hope. So I think kind of having more direct democracy would be valuable. I mentioned before that there's this big tension between representative democracy and political equality. I think kind of having more use of referendums in the initiative would help us kind of ameliorate political inequalities in the US context. I think having a much broader system of civic education in schools than the United States does would help ameliorate this issue of political ignorance. If you taught students much more intensively about political institutions, but also about kind of substantive policy issues, you'd help inform them when they become adults about politics and help them vote more autonomously. Kind of similarly, there are kind of straightforward reforms to campaign financing that would help kind of address to some extent the problem of money in American politics, the fact that wealthy Americans and business interests have more power than the rest of Americans. Kind of less feasibly, I think kind of reform of the US's electoral system would help American democracies in a bunch of ways. So having a more kind of proportional electoral system would help fragment the party system and allow voters more choice in the ballot booth, which would give them more autonomy. So you'll notice this is a kind of laundry list of institutional reforms. How I think of all this is, I think none of these is going to be a kind of silver bullet that kills what ails American democracy, a kind of cure-all. But I think each of these reforms would really help improve American democracy on the margin. So it's not like kind of the situation is hopeless. I think there are clear ways forward. It's just a matter of kind of getting the political will to actually enact these.
Well, that's simple. Getting people to act and vote on these core issues, not a problem. We'll get it done before the next election. Adam, thank you so much for joining us on why this is a complex problem, and it's a very thorny one that you navigate very, very well. And I and our audience really appreciate you being on Why.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, and I've loved talking about this stuff with you.
You are listening to Jack Russell Weinstein and Adam Lovett on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'll be back with a few more thoughts right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We were talking to Adam Lovett about the American democracy and using his book, Democratic Failures and the Ethics of Democracy, to investigate it in what I hope was an accessible way. And what I mean by that is not, do I hope everyone understood the issues, because of course I hope they do, but rather, we almost never used the words Republican or Democrat. We almost never used Trump and Biden. And I think I am, rather than Adam, the only person who's guilty of invoking those names and those terms. And one of the reasons why I asked Adam on the show is precisely because I felt that we could do that. At this time of tremendous conflict, when we are at each other's throats, when so many people feel that whichever way the election goes, the other way, the way that we don't want is the death of democracy, the death of America, you know, whatever. When we're so upset, philosophy can actually help. Philosophy can allow us to take a step back, walk away from the triggering issues, and ask about the fundamental questions of the country and the culture and the democratic process that we find ourselves in. Why is democracy good? That is the underlying question from the entire conversation. Why is democracy good? And democracy is good because it promotes equality, it promotes autonomy, and it promotes self authorship. And what I mean by that is democracy is good because it puts everyone, ideally, on an equal playing field. Democracy is good because everybody hears their voices represented in the legislations and legislature. And democracy is good because people get to make decisions for themselves. And so the question of whether American democracy is failing isn't to be answered by asking, did our candidate win or did our policy succeed? The way to answer the question, is American democracy failing, is to ask, are we failing to make people equal? Are we failing to give people decisions over their own lives? And are we failing to let people construct the rules and the laws that they themselves have to live by? Those are deep philosophical questions. There are plenty of disagreements to keep us energized as we talk about them, but they are ways that we can address the fundamental issues while being on the same team, in the same club, in the same conversation, because we all want America to succeed. With all of that said, if you've been listening to this episode on Sunday evening on Prairie Public, please know that a longer version with almost 30 more minutes of discussion is available online and as a podcast. Visit Why Radio Show, whyradioshow.org, to listen or subscribe for free. For everyone else, please rate us on iTunes and Spotify to help spread the word about the show. Follow us on the usual social networks. Our handle is always at Why Radio Show. And please help us continue broadcasting by making your tax-deductible donation at whyradioshow.org. Click donate in the upper right-hand corner to go to UND Alumni's donation portal. We exist solely on the money you provide. Thank you yet again to Adam for joining us, the folks at Prairie Public, especially Skip Wood, our long-suffering engineer. I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, signing off for Why Radio. Thanks for listening. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album, Lua e Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.